So anyway, we've got you behind your bar with your two shelves of books.
Yes.
What else was there?
Well, it's just the rest of the start of the women's service and a small restaurant which was run for the members in the basement.
Was there? I see.
Yes. So there was then what was a very important creation is Miss Stretch's idea. She created this junior council of the society, which was for the young professional women, and to that belonged all these first women barristers and solicitors and architects and the women who got into the top ranks of the civil service and so on. And it was a very interesting and very lively group indeed. You had to have some kind of a profession or a job of some kind at any rate. You couldn't just be doing a useful job in your own home. You just had to. It was for the young, the new professional.
I understand,
But it wasn't limited to the professions. I mean, anyone who was doing any kind of job could belong. But all these first women civil servants, like Dame Enid Russell Smith and Dame Mary Smeaton and Dame Alex Kilroy and all of them belonged, and the first women barristers and first women solicitors. And
what did they do, Miss Dewey?
Her design was chosen for the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre, the first great achievement of a woman architect.
Yes. So did they come and meet regularly, at regular intervals?
Yes, they came and meet. They had a meeting every month at which somebody or other quite distinguished spoke. And then there were originally six groups. In the end there were four groups. There was a political group and a literary group and an artist group and a social group. And they had one of them had a meeting in town, so it was a weekly meeting as well as a monthly meeting, and there was a walkers club and there was a bridge circle, and the whole thing was extremely
very lively. With an average age of
under 30 then.
Was there really?
Yes.
And what was it called? This?
The Junior Council of the London
Society
of Women's Service.
I see. So in this converted pub you had what, a big meeting room, did you?
Yes. Well, we did better, of course, when Miss Sarah Clegg had given us the new buildings in... Because there we had a magnificent hall with proper stage lighting and enough seating for 250 people, and a big restaurant in the basement of the members' room, and the library was housed rather more adequately. So even then, when we left, it was outgrowing it. It had a very nice, properly fitted library, and the members' room was shelved, and then there was a big bookstore down.
So the real a complex of rooms, really, in that
big
building.
There was a agent's office in front. She was also the secretary of the junior council, and then there was the members' room, and then there was the library. Then the other side of a passage, there was this big hall with this big restaurant down below. Bookstore under the library, caretaker's flat, and then the offices of the society above.
I see. So you had three floors, including the basement, did you?
We had four floors, really, because there were two offices, part of which was left to the Women's Employment Federation and part to a civil service organisation.
I see. So it was a real sort of... But if we go back to the... I can't quite remember when this second building we've been talking about was built.
It was the last public thing that Mrs. Fawcett did when she laid the foundation stone in 1929. And it was probably opened in 1930.
I see, yes. So if we confine ourselves to the pub between 1926 and 1930...
1930.
That was... You presumably had a big room. What accommodation did you have there, then?
Well, there was only the library, and in the committee room, the Hansards lived in the committee room, and that was all there was. But it, of course, the first 4 years, it was a very small library.
Yes, of course, yes, yes.
It didn't
yes,
need very it. Much yeah. accommodation in those days.
Yes, that's very splendid. So anyway, what happened when you were a librarian? Were you librarian and nothing else? Because if you only had two shelves of books to look after,
yes.
and presumably to answer people's queries,
yes.
was that
well,
a full-time
you see
job?
Rather Gandhi, yes, it gradually became so. You began the day by going through 6 newspapers and extracting all the cuttings, and they all had, of course, to be properly indexed and so on. And nothing had been done, so that everything, the original few books had to be catalogued, and all the new ones had to be, of course, also catalogued, and the whole thing had to be developed. And then, of course, there was a little library committee.
Yes,
on the whole.
So, I mean, you really, in a way, you built it up.
Yes.
So, anyway, did you have any assistance at all, or were you just the only person?
Well, Jane Norton, who was the Society's honorary librarian, was always most helpful and did a lot of work. And she
was your boss,
put
it crudely, was she?
She was my boss, so far as Philippa Strachey wasn't. I mean,
Yes.
And she was the chairman of our library committee. And
so anyway,
we always had a very good library committee.
Did you?
Mm.
Yes. They really did take an interest in the library.
They did take an interest. And of course we had no money at all. I feel one would start the committee meeting with perhaps 4 and 6 and the till towards the purchase of any books which we decided to buy. Mm. The committee was very, very generous and always giving us books. Mrs. Cavendish Benting.
Yes, I've seen her name in several books.
Well, the Cavendish Benting Library, which she collected originally.
She just handed it over, did she?
Well, that had rather a checkered history, too. Because I should not go any further. But,
would you like me to switch off while you...
I mean, you won't be publishing anything without...
no, of course not.
without my... that anyhow, she gave it originally, we not being then barely in existence, to the National Union of Societies for Equal Citizenship. And then they couldn't house it, they hadn't got room, and it came to live with us because we could house it on a sort of loan, you see. And then when they split into two, Mrs. Cavendish Benting found to her horror that it had been allotted to the Towns Women's Guilds, who couldn't possibly make the slightest use of it, that in the division of property between the organisations, this had not been done. And then we had rather a long fight because she wanted it transferred, the ownership transferred to us.
Mm.
And finally they did agree to that. And a new trust deed was drawn.
Yes, I mean, it
gave us the ownership of the...
Anyway, I mean, the Townsmen's Guild wouldn't really need a library. Really,
no, the last thing was they wouldn't ever have made the slightest use of it, of course. It's not the kind of book that they would want. It's a lovely library, of course.
When did you start accepting manuscripts and things like that? I mean, it's much more than a library now, isn't it? It's also an archive, isn't it?
Yes.
Was that from the very beginning,
well,
really?
We went to... everything grew up almost by accident, you see, because we got the Cavendish Benting Library, and that was a lovely collection with all these antiquarian books in it. And then we, after the death of Lena Eckenstein, who wrote Women Under Monasticism, literary executor, gave us her books, which consisted partly of these extremely interesting books on female mystics in the Middle Ages, in Latin and French and German and English. And her own collection, which was the first and early editions of women writers. And that started us on ourselves collecting women writers, which we hadn't done before. All these early plays by women, the early novels by
So you broaden out from the history of the women's movement to the history of women's activities in general.
Yes. And then the first thing we were given in the manuscript line, after Mrs. Fawcett's death, we were given her correspondence. And that started the autograph collection. And then we were given by the Anderson family the letters which Elizabeth Garrett Anderson had written to Elmira Davis when she was trying to get her medical training. And that's, of course, that's a great treasure. And among Mrs. Fawcett's letters were the letters which were written from Holloway Prison by Dundee Stead when he was imprisoned from tub
charge. Yes.
And then gradually that grew and grew, and people finding there was an autograph collection proceeded to give us
build
the
on it. Yes.
Letters, and then, of course, the manuscripts began coming in.
Why then didn't you get the collection that's now in the London Museum?
Well, that unfortunately,
because it always seemed to me the natural
place.
Without,
of course, it was quite wrong, but of course it was a militant collection, and the militants didn't want us to have it.
That was still the case, even then, was it?
I suppose so. Anyhow, we were not.
I see. I mean, I don't know quite when that collection was created. Was it attached to the Suffragette Fellowship, that collection?
It was certainly, I'm not quite sure who owned it, but would it have been the Suffragette Fellowship?
I honestly don't know. I mean, there's a lot of stuff there that's been collected by Edith Howe Martin, among other people.
Yes, and of course she was a very dear friend of mine and very kind to the Fawcett Library. But she very likely, I don't know when it went to them, but of course it wasn't the right place.
No, well, I mean, it seems to be absurd that it should be split up like this.
Yes.
Mind you, they look after
it
very well.
They've got, beautifully, yes. What's more, they've got one of our minute books, which they oughtn't have, but they wouldn't let me have it.
No, really, I didn't know
it
that.
It turned up, it was very tiresome, because it turned up in a cupboard that somebody bought in a sale. And they realised that it was of some interest to somebody, and they handed it to the... they had heard of the Suffragette Museum, you see. Mm. They handed it to them.
I see, yeah.
It ought, of course, to have been...
ridiculous, yeah.
books. But they had it beautifully bound and take great care of it. I mean, they certainly look after the stuff.
Yes, that's certainly my experience. I mean, I have worked through that collection.
Yes.
Edith Howe Martin was a friend of yours, was she?
Yes.
It's very interesting, because she's an obviously very important figure in the whole Women's Freedom League, isn't she?
Yes, very important indeed in the Women's Freedom League.
How did you know her, Miss Dewey, then? I mean, simply because she came into the library, didn't she?
Yes, she became, like many of the militants, a member of the, what was then the London Society of Women's Service.
Mm.
And that's when
I see, yes. She was a very intelligent woman, wasn't she? She was a scientist, wasn't she?
Yes, very intelligent indeed. And then finally, of course, she and her husband went to Australia.
Yes.
Of course, latterly, she was very much absorbed in the birth control movement.
Was she?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Main final.
Yes. What sort of person was she when you knew her? That's a rather vague question, but I mean, put it this way, maybe to make it more precise, why did she become a friend of yours? Why did you like her?
Well, she was a very nice person, I mean.
Yes.
And we just liked each other, and we became... a lot of people among the members became friends.
Yes, oh, I'm sure they did. I'd really wondered, was she an attractive woman to look at?
Yes, she was very attractive indeed.
Yes.
And... political union, weren't they? And yes. Much more democratic, of course. I mean, their, yes. their split was not on the question of militancy, but on the question of the democratic management of the society, wasn't it?
Mm. Yes. Did the Women's Freedom League have anything to do with the Fawcett Library or that complex of organisations, really?
No,
it was quite separate,
wasn't
it?
Quite separate, yes.
Yes, yes. Because she continued to belong to both, I suppose,
yes,
didn't she?
Yes.
Yes. Because that's another line. I mean, I see your point. In a way, of course, it does attract some members, doesn't it, around about 1978-9, that period. It attracts some. But I agree that the EWSPU is a separate creation, though there is continuity via Mrs. Pankhurst, I suppose.
Yes.
It's interesting, yes. Mm. Yes.
And, of course, her husband went right back to the... Women's property agitation.
Yes, well, he's involved in the earliest Manchester activity, isn't he? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But, so anyway, you've got the library launched, and presumably the whole business of moving into your new building was quite a performance, wasn't it, I should have thought, in 1930.
Well, as I say, you mean in 1930?
Mm.
Well, the library was still small enough for us to carry the books across by hand. Didn't have to have a pantechnic.
Was it really? Was it? Yes.
Well, it's only about 3 doors down the road. It wasn't very far.
Yes, I see. And I would be silly to ask you, was the place where the library was used primarily as a library in 1926-30? Or was it also a meeting place?
It was a meeting place.
It
wasn't a library. The library was in the only room that they had apart from the committee room in which meetings could take place. And in fact, in that little room, we had the dinner which celebrated Elizabeth Scott's winning the design for the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre.
So it was really an all-purpose...
Yes,
yes. Because what's really happened, I mean, my impression of what's happened, you must correct me if I'm wrong, is that gradually the library has taken over, in a sense, and that it now is primarily a library.
Well, I wish it were so. I mean, it seems to me that the society now is not appreciating the...
Oh, I see your point. I mean,
The trouble is that we had all thought that in the end the library would be the survivor, and that such money as there is in the Women's Service Trust would eventually come to the library. But it doesn't look now as if there's very much money left in the trust end. And the future of the library is in
Yes, the situation when you first went there was the reverse, wasn't it? People didn't go there for the books, did they?
No, because there were no books left.
No. So in that sense, the library has taken over.
Yes.
But in those days...
Of course, most of the people who now join for the library.
Yes, precisely, yes, yes.
And very interesting work is being done there. Reports of the uses that are being made of it, I'm greatly impressed.
It's a marvellous library. But it was always a lending library, was it? I mean,
always a lending library. And we lent books extremely freely. For many things which you couldn't borrow from other libraries, we were willing to lend the government publications and periodicals.
Well, Hansard's
Well,
precisely.
Yes.
Anyway, I mean, by supposing one takes it all, I mean, how many books did you have by the time you moved into the new building? That is in 1930, would you say? I suppose you could find this out from the annual reports, really, couldn't you?
I don't think you would. I think a couple of thousand would be there.
Yes.
Outside.
Yes, I mean, they'd fill that wall and another wall.
The library was a very, I haven't got a picture of it here, unfortunately. It was a very nice little library, square building, completely shelved all around, very nicely in oak with oak apart from a small case up by my desk, which had the more valuable books, other than the books in the Cavendish Painting Library, which were in their own shelves in the members' room. Then my desk was in the corner there, round table in the middle, with chairs round, and the whole of the wall completely shelved with books right up to the top, apart from the fireplace where there was that portrait of Mrs. Fawcett, a very nice, enlarged photograph. And the rest of the books, all the periodicals, the government publications, were in the bookstore.
Underneath?
Underneath, yes. And the bottom of the these shelves had the cabinets also in oak with all the news cuttings all around the...
I see. So it was very well organised.
Very well organised. Built, purpose-built.
Was it?
Yes.
To but your specification? I mean, did you have ideas?
No, no doubt that they knew exactly what the library consisted of and provided in accordance with that. But of course, by 1939, the library was splitting at the seams, and it wasn't.
Was it? I mean, it was bursting out of that room anyway.
Bursting out of that.
Yes. So how many books did you have when you moved to St. Anne's?
Right. They let us put up our shelves in a quite big lecture room and gave us a lot of space at the top of the house. And then all around me, I had a desk inside the front door with a counter in front of it and a large cupboard and the works of reference around me. There, and all the news cuttings and the books were in the lecture room. But, of course, they hadn't got room for all our library. And after we got down here, the next thing we had to do was to find homes for the rest. And the Sacred Heart Convent took a whole lot of our books, and LMH took our Hansards, and St. Hugh's gave us space in a...
It must have been rather heartbreaking in a way to see it all split
it was
up.
I had to pop about a good deal from place to place. And of course the Hansards were virtually out of use because they were in packing cases, and they to us and gave us a lot of space. And when I divided up the books originally, when we were having to move in great haste, of course what happened was frightfully quickly, and after we were bombed,
you were actually bombed.
Bombed.
That caused you to move, did it?
Bombed, yes.
Was it really? I didn't know that.
But it was the member room that got it, you see, and most of the library was not directly bombed. And though, of course, a great deal of dust and dirt, we did not lose any of the books.
But the Cavendish Bentinck collection was in the members' room, wasn't it?
Well, that had been immediately before the outbreak of war, when we realised it was coming. I was in Switzerland at the time, and came back, and we all sent back in haste. And immediately before the war, we packed the whole of the Cavendish Bentinck library books into packing cases and put them in the basement. And the,
very good thing you did.
The bookstore, yes.
So presumably they would have been destroyed if you hadn't done that.
Well, no, I think they would have been dirty, but I think they would have survived because it was the front of the building that...
I see. Yes.
And so then I divided them as the things we must take to Oxford at once. And then there was B, which we second home was in, C, the ones which could stay if necessary. And when got the Sacred Heart Convent. And unfortunately, the B had contained all the most unsuitable possible books.
All on birth control.
Yes, all on birth control and divorce and the works of Hemlock Ellis and all that kind of thing.
Wow. What actually were your categories, A, B, and C?
A charming nun there. And she said to me, Mr. I wonder if you'd mind keeping some of these books on the top shelf. So I said, I know, I said, very, very sorry indeed, Mother. We are going to remove them as soon as possible, since I get something to do them and substitute some others. Oh, we don't find them, Mr. Wynne. We find them very interesting. It's only the children we're thinking of. The suffrage and women's subjects, of course, had to go down. And
so that was A,
we got
it?
A, you see. And then the legal sections, which included, of course, all these things, and the
government papers?
Government papers we brought down here, very, very valuable and important. We didn't want to lose them. And then certain less important periodicals were left behind in C, and a lot of very general stuff on subjects like employment and housing and all that kind of things, which eventually we didn't use. But B was legal.
How did it change? I mean, how did the activities change in that period, if at all?
Well, they just expanded. They didn't change. More and more people were using it for asking questions on all sorts of public matters. And
so your memoranda were building up all the time.
They were building up. And of course it was, as far as the society was concerned, as I was telling you, it was very lively with the junior.
Yes. What did they do? They had these weekly meetings. What did they? They just had discussions, did they, or what?
A lot of very distinguished people came and spoke to them. And there was always a dinner beforehand in the restaurant, both in the for the weekly ones and for the big one in the month.
I see. So it really was quite a social centre.
Well, there was something going on almost every night after these meetings, and then the bridge. It was open every night till 8 in any case. I wasn't there till 8, but receptionist who came was about 12 or so.
I see. I mean, did you find yourself being drawn into these activities, or were you always the librarian separate from?
No, I was very much a member of the junior council. And,
were you really?
Yes, and part in all the activities.
So the usefulness of this was really getting them to meet one another, getting a certain amount of mutual encouragement.
The strangest idea was, but in the case of men, you see, they had the men's clubs, they also had the pubs, which women didn't go much to in those days, where people in different professions met each other. There was no meeting place for the women who were entering the professions to meet each other.
So really it's like a sort of female Athenaeum or something. I mean,
it didn't mean that the women who were becoming architects and barristers and solicitors and civil servants and so on did meet each other and have each other's point of view and discuss each other's problems if any.
Yes, that's most interesting. Yes, the restaurant. Did you have a restaurant in the pub, or not originally?
Yes,
you
the
did.
Pub,
did you?
Yes.
Yes, I see. So
small restaurant. It got bigger.
I see. What was it like as a restaurant? Was it a good restaurant? Would you say?
It was a cheap restaurant.
Yes, with snacks. Was it all?
Well, I provided lunch originally for about a shilling, and the dinners were, I think, half a crown, and they were three-course meals, quite nice, but within the very limited means of the members.
I see, yes. So did they serve themselves? Was it a self-service thing?
It was self-service for lunch, but I think the dinners, I think it was handed round for the dinners.
So anyway, I suppose, again, one could find it out from the reports, but, I mean, how many people tended to come, would you say, for lunch and dinner? And could one generalise at all?
Well, quite a lot. And we had the bigger restaurant, I suppose. The lunches would probably be... I don't know. Of course, the staff usually lunched there, and people around about came in and they brought their friends. But of course, it was restricted to members.
Yes, yes, I see. Yes, yes. Yes, and this late to the Minerva Club, then?
Well, the Minerva Club had gained quite separate, and Miss Reeves, of course she was a Minerva. Except when she died, there was no more Minerva.
Because doesn't the Minerva Club do the same sort of thing, in a way?
Well, of course it's now no more, but it did have an occasional evening meeting, and had some good speakers and so on, and I used to go quite frequently when anything being any speaker that possibly interesting, and of course they also had people residents, didn't they, as well?
Yes, it was a sort of hospital place as well.
Yes.
Whereas you didn't in your...
Well, originally, we did, when first we were in the new women's service house in Marsham Street, we still had the lease of Skittles, which was the pub. And we did have two or three bedrooms there, where members spending a night in London could...
You mean you didn't own these rooms, or at least you owned them, but they were run by the pub, were they? I mean...
Pub had ceased to be a pub.
Oh, I see. It wasn't. I see. It was converted, but you still had these rooms as bedrooms.
We had no license, or anything like.
Yes, I see.
Like that.
Yeah.
I don't think that they were licensed in a house.
But you had bedrooms anyway, in
we
it.
We had a couple of bedrooms on it, three bedrooms or something like.
But eventually, these were taken over.
There had been offices, you see, before we moved to the. It was just a way of using the premises while we had the. These were quite useful for people who were spending the night in.
Yes. But in the new building, there weren't any of these.
No,
I see. But the impression I have, you see, is that many of the suffragettes go to the Minerva Club. Is that wrong? I mean,
would have, but of course it hasn't existed for long.
No, I'm really saying, would you say that your body was the social centre for the non-suffragette feminists, and the Minerva Club was the social centre for the suffragette feminists?
There were quite a number of the ex-militants, as I say, actually.
Joined you?
Joined us. But the Minerva Club, of course, kept up. It was an excellent place where the former militants could meet each other, of course, because they had otherwise, I suppose, no particular meeting place, had they?
I suppose not, except insofar as you define the Women's Freedom League people as militants, which they were.
They
in
hadn't
a sense,
got their premises, had they?
Hadn't they? I don't know.
I think they must have run the. Did they run the paper finally from the Minerva Club? I'm not sure.
What interests me is the Six Point Group didn't have any connection with your organisation either, did it?
No.
I mean. See, I had a very interesting discussion with Dame Marjorie about this, and Dame Marjorie is extremely...
I don't think it started until after the First World War at all, did it?
No, it didn't, no.
And then they had 6 points which they wanted reforms on, and that was all right, of course, excepting that whenever you got one, you had to have a new... Well, it wasn't like the 10 little nigger boys. I mean, you shouldn't then have 5-point group and a 4-point.
So there would be disputes about which group.
I don't know whether they ever had any arguments about which point.
Yes.
I know very little about them.
The fact that you know little about them is significant, because it does show the continuance of this. I mean, see, one of the interesting things about this whole period, as I think I probably mentioned in my letter to you, was all these splits, one after another. I mean, splits in your part of the movement and splits in the suffragette part and the split between you and the suffragettes.
Yeah.
Now, why are there so many splits? Is there any explanation that you can generalise about, because if anything, surely, women ought to have stuck together in a period which is still really a man's world.
Yes, but I think that the question when we left the NUACC was whether it's better to go out for a whole lot of things or whether to concentrate on the one thing that you have the expert knowledge of. And of course the society did have the expert knowledge in the field of women's employment. It was the convener of the Joint Committee on Women in the Civil Service, and I think the society should be right in saying that it drafted the first of the sex discrimination removal.
Yes.
And
you did a work like that.
Well, I was. I dare say there still is, but of course I've been away for 7 years. General committee to it for all the women's societies.
Yes, I can't remember what that's called. National Council of Women, is it all?
No, the National Council of Women. We were always affiliated to that.
Hmm.
That, of course, is a very large organisation, and very middle of the line, very good, very sound, and quite influential, especially in some local areas, I believe. But then, of course, it's much, and that's all over the place, isn't it? I mean, it is a big body. And a great many of the women's organisations are affiliated to it, including the...
So that is the umbrella, in a way, then?
That would be the umbrella there. And then there is also this other, what is it called, you know, this committee which does meet at the women's... it's true that probably a lot of very little societies can't individually do very much, but whether one can concentrate on one's own field, you know, it's a biggish field, of course. I mean, the employment of unions have always stood out.
Yes.
They didn't wish to be mixed up with middle class organisations.
Yes, yes, yes.
Which removed the industrial women more or less in bulk.
Yes, yes, of course, that's not your fault at all. I mean, not have their little worlds, and they want to be in control of their little worlds, and they don't want to sacrifice that independence.
No, and of course, if you have too large an umbrella, you do dissipate your energies, don't you?
Yes.
I mean, you can't really work them all at once.
No, there's another point, isn't there, that if you have a lot of small organisations, don't you get a certain amount of rivalry between them, so that everybody...
Okay, so, yes.
Everybody works hard, in a sense.
Yes,
don't they?
I mean, that might be a good thing.
Well, I was going to say, in a sense, there might be something to be said.
Yes.
Did you feel that was so in between the wars, actually?
Well, you see, the library has always been entirely neutral.
Oh, I wasn't really thinking of the library. I was really thinking of the organisations around it, you know. And did you ever feel, or do you feel now, that were consciously competing in any sense with the six-point group or with the Women's Freedom League or with any
of the others? I think that they were devoting themselves to their own particular field, of the women's movement. I think they were probably right. But the library, of course, was always...
Quite separate,
though it was supported by the society, and though it was originally part of it until it became a separate organisation, and nevertheless, I always felt that it existed for the benefit of all.
Yes, including six-point groupers or anybody.
Of course, certainly, I mean, couldn't dream of barring it, not only to certainly not a six-point group, but to any person at all who could use it, even if they were using it for purposes which meant it not actually approved.
Yes, oh, of course, yes. Yes, I understand. So, in fact, you must have seen, you know, in the library, many suffragettes.
Oh, many, yes, and...
Yes.
Many of all people, all sorts of kinds of different interests and points of view.
Yes. The person who does interest me, because one suffragette who does interest me a lot, as I think I probably mentioned in my letter, was Mrs. Billington Gregg.
Yes.
And,
don't you think?
Yes. Well, I mean, I don't know, did you see very much of her, actually?
She used to use the... library. She didn't become a friend in the way that Edith had Martin.
No.
She used to use the library quite a lot, and as I say, we've got all these papers that she...
Yes, I mean, she was at the end of her life, you see, writing her memoirs, as you know.
Yes, yes, and also she always hoped to write... a biography of Mrs. Despard, but of course nothing in the end came of that. I always hoped that somebody sometime will write that. Yes, they won't discuss this and that occasionally, but you know, I didn't...
And what was she like, simply to you, when she came to borrow books? I mean, was she...
Very nice and friendly. And,
was she? Yes. And did she try and... Presumably she must have sort of consulted you about her projects, didn't she? I mean...
Well, of course I knew that she was engaged on this life of Mrs.
Despard.
And she did, of course, get together a great deal of information. It was a pity that she didn't have the time to write it.
And then her memoirs... Did she talk to you about those?
No,
at all?
I never saw any.
Yes, because you see,
they thought they would be extremely interesting.
Well, they are. You saw a lot of her, I suppose,
yes,
didn't you?
Indeed.
I mean, she seems to be a sort of Eminence Grise in a way. I mean,
she
doesn't push herself forward at all.
No, never did.
Is that so?
Never. I mean, and yet, of course, she was the real person who mattered. Well, of course, after all, the experience, starting as secretary in 1907 and going right on until 1950, you see, gave her an immense fund of experience. And she was, of course, totally absorbed in it. And we showed her.
Yes.
Very great. She and Ray Strachey, between them were the people who really ran the...
were they as Miss Reeve ran the Minerva Club?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, what were Philippa's qualities, really? She was just a very good organiser, was she, in a quiet
very
way?
Good organiser. And, well, of course, the first thing she organised was rather... disaster, because she organised that original mud march. You know.
Oh, yes.
I mean, she was always there in the back ground. She was voted to Mrs. Fawcett. And Mrs. Fawcett, of course, was never you'd call a push-forth on it, was she? But she had an immense influence, and I dare say Dame Marjorie told you she was very attached to her.
Oh, yes. But Philippa, was she good with paperwork then? I mean, was that where she was good?
She was
or?
Quite good with paperwork. She wrote good minutes, good annual reports and all that kind of thing. And the subsequent things that she organised were absolute models, I think, having learned from the Mud March. Some of those great processions, she was really the person who... organising, and of course it required immense forethought and planning to do these things so that they went absolutely without a hitch.
Oh, yes.
They did. I mean,
Yes. By the time you knew her, of course, this was after her perception day, wasn't it? So she was really an official, sort of behind the scenes, was she?
Yes,
sort of
she was there, yes.
Yes. What, was she good with people? I mean...
I should think moderately so. I wouldn't say outstandingly.
Was she rather shy, do you think? I mean, was that why she... So you don't... Mm. I think she...
Well, I found with her, I don't know whether it's a characteristic of all the stresses, but I... You know, with most people, how their minds are working, but I never knew how her mind was working.
Because she didn't sort of think out loud. She
No, I never. I mean, most people, you can tell, even if they're not saying anything, that I never did know how.
But, did you? Yes, because she was rather senior figure, I suppose,
yes,
wasn't she?
Quite,
so I suppose one would be intimidated by if you were a young newcomer.
Yes, yes. Especially as an employer.
Yes, well, yes, absolutely. But she seems to me one of those people who perhaps are in danger of being neglected, you know, because
she certainly shouldn't be, because she
was
of great importance, and as you say, she never took a sort of commanding...
No, she didn't thrust herself forward.
She was there, but she was certainly the motive power.
Yes, yes. Raystraight, she...
They were a very good team, of course, because she was very forthcoming and...
Yes. I'm just trying to think. Wasn't Ray Strachey married? Who did Oliver Strachey marry? Oliver Strachey married Ray.
Ray Strachey, who was Ray Costello.
That's right. Yeah.